Good morning. Welcome to Grand Rounds. Just want to make an announcement that we're having our, I think, a 16th annual update in internal medicine, for those of you who don't know, and the brochures are going to come out soon. And this is a course that we get over 200 attendees routinely, and we have great speakers. We have it over at the Marriott over in Boca Center, and it's the last week of March. It's on Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, and Sunday morning, and the residents and, of course, the permanent members, the medical staff, are all invited. There's no charge for the residents, and we just have great speakers, a lot of them from the Mayo Clinic, University of Miami, et cetera. So you're certainly invited and welcome to attend and encouraged to attend. This morning, I'd like to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. George Coriarty. A lot of you are familiar with Dr. Coriarty if you're ordering any interventional radiology studies. Dr. Coriarty received his medical education from the State University of New York Health Science Center in Brooklyn. He served his medical internship at Long Island Jewish Medical Center and residency at the State University of New York Health Science Center at Brooklyn. His interventional radiology fellowship was the University of Colorado Health Science Center. He's certified by the American Board of Radiology and certified of added qualification vascular and interventional radiology. Currently, Dr. Coriarty is medical director of interventional radiology and interventional oncology of Boca Regional. He's a volunteer affiliate faculty of FAU Charles Smith School of Medicine. This morning, Dr. Coriarty's topic is hepatobiliary interventions in interventional radiology. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Coriarty.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, Dr. Rosenthal. Can everybody hear me okay? Here in the back, can this go up anymore, the volume, or just want to make sure everybody can hear? All right, well, thank you for the warm welcome. I'm gonna try not to make a very wordy slide. This might be one of the wordiest slides you're gonna have. If this is kind of the world of IR where I live, hepatobiliary is a big chunk of that. And it's a lot to cover in one talk, and certainly a lot to cover in 50 minutes. So we're not going to get to see like a lot of the tiny details and a lot of the data of what we do, but we're going to get kind of that 30,000-foot view of interventional hepatobiliary stuff. But hopefully you'll have a good idea of what we do, a lot of our procedures. A lot of what we do in hepatobiliary seems a little routine, a little mundane, and other stuff can be quite challenging, quite exciting, and quite technical. But for our patients, even the things that seem pretty mundane to us, have been doing it for a really long time, can seem kind of like this, because they're going through it for the first time. And for them, really nothing is mundane or routine. A lot of what I'm going to show is things that cases that are done. Actually, all the cases that I'm going to show are from here, from this hospital that I've done here. But they're not all of them done just by me, because interventional radiology really is all about teamwork. There's only so much you can do as an individual. You know, we're all trained as individual silos. We're all trained to work independently as physicians. But there's a lot more you can do as a team, because you certainly can't do certain things as an individual by yourself. And all of these cases I'm going to show involve a lot of teamwork. Teamwork with surgery, oncology, radiation oncology, GI, interventional GI, anesthesia, internal medicine, the techs and nurses, you know, certainly a lot of teamwork is needed. And from your guys' standpoint, interventional radiology is made better by the teamwork of everybody. Working with interventional radiology tends to make all these other services better as well. And it's all in the interest, of course, of serving the patients. So we're going to dive into our first patient, 90-year-old woman with right upper quadrant pain, nausea, fever, Murphy's sign. Of course, we're all thinking patient has cholecystitis, right? We got the history. We know the answer. But we're going to do some imaging. So here's the ultrasound of the gallbladder. And we see the gallstone here at the gallbladder neck, and it's shadowing. This is a stone. And you see the gallbladder wall thickening. This is the best place to see it. It's actually right along the edge of the liver, because you can be fooled on this side. But if you see the thickening on this side, that's pretty diagnostic. And really, we don't need to go much further than that. If you get a diagnostic answer in ultrasound, we're pretty much done. But here we have CT. You know, again, it shows gallstone. It's a little harder to see the gallbladder wall thickening, a little bit of fluid on the CT. So maybe this was read as equivocal. So then, of course, we go to our hepatobiliary scan. Again, you don't need to do all of these, but we just seem to have them. And you can see our hepatobiliary scan on the left, which is normal. And what shows is you see the liver, initially you're able to see the bile ducts and it empties into the small bowel. And you also see filling of the gallbladder. I'm going to just play that again because it went kind of fast. So you can see, you know, liver, bile ducts, small bowel, and filling of the gallbladder. That's normal. If you look at our patient on the other side, you know, you see the liver, see the bile ducts, you see the bowel, but you don't see the gallbladder. So that's pretty diagnostic. And with hepatobiliary scans, the sensitivity is pretty high, 97%, and specificity is 94%. Now, all that tells you really is that the gallbladder is not filling, the cystic duct obstruction. Of course, with hepatobiliary scan, you can look at other things, bile leaks and things like that, and obstruction. So our woman who has acute cholecystitis, she's 90 years old, she's not a surgical candidate. So what do we do for this person? Well, we're gonna do this. So this is the gallbladder, and we can see our needle going into the gallbladder here. This is done under ultrasound. We can do the entire procedure under ultrasound, and here you can see our wire being placed under ultrasound. But we prefer to do these with X-ray fluoroscopy, because once you get to this point, it's hard to really get an idea of what's going on. But when we have the patients downstairs, now we do that in the ICU all the time under ultrasound because we have to, but we certainly prefer to bring the patients down because then you have the luxury of seeing your wires and catheters going into the gallbladder, and then you can certainly see if the cystic duct is blocked. You can see if there's flow into the common bile duct. You see the intrahepatic bile duct. And you see a lot more if you have the fluoroscopy there. So this is a cholecystostomy, so we put the tube in the gallbladder, and we drain the bile out. So then what happens to this patient? Well, this patient is too old to undergo and too sick to undergo cholecystectomy. So unfortunately, they end up stuck with having this gallbladder drain. And the gallbladder drain is a bit inconvenient. It connects to a bag, to the leg, and the bile is kind of draining constantly. But for people who have no other choice, you know, it's the way to live. So at a minimum, they have to have this drain in for 6 weeks if they don't go for surgery. And the reason for that is we need to have a tract form where that drain is. Because if we take that cholecystostomy tube out before the 6 months is 6 weeks is up, you can get a bile leak, and you have bile all over the abdomen. So we always make them wait a minimum of 6 weeks to do anything else after that. So what is this after that? So this patient now is stuck with this tube. They're unhappy. They don't want to go home having a drain to the bag. So what we can do is we can go through that cystic duct that's blocked. We can actually get across it, and it's a little hard to see maybe, but we get a catheter down. We get a wire through the cystic duct down into the duodenum, and we place a stent. This is akin to a ureteral double J stent, except part of the J is in the gallbladder, part of the J in the duodenum, and now the bile can leak internally, and we don't have to have the cholecystostomy tube there all the time. So this works really well, and you can see how it ends up, and you can see how it works. You know, the bile drains from the gallbladder nicely down. The downside to these tubes and why we don't use them all the time is they don't last forever, and eventually something needs to be done with this tube. Either it has to be changed endoscopically if we give up the access, or, as in this case, this patient ended up coming back 8 months later with the tube actually broken. This particular tube that I used was not one that we had used in the bile ducts, but it seemed to work initially. But for some reason, it ended up breaking into pieces. And then this patient came back 8 months later with cholecystitis again. So what do we do with this patient? Went back in, snared the pieces of tube that were left, and you can kind of see like fragments of that tube go down, and then pushed it out into the duodenum, and then placed this. This is a little bit different. This is akin to an external internal biliary drain, except it goes through the gallbladder. Here's the gallbladder, so it's going through the gallbladder. There's holes here in the drain. There's holes actually all along, and there's holes down at the bottom. So now it continues to drain to the inside, but it leaves us a tube on the outside. So if we need to flush it, if we need to change it, that would be really easy for the patient. We don't have to put the patient through an ERCP to change it out. The advantage of this over cholecystostomy tube is that you don't have to have a bag connected to the patient's leg. Bile's not draining out. They have to empty. It does drain internally, but it gives us the way to deal with the tube and change it out over time. So, of course, a lot of patients with gallstones also have common bile duct stones. I mean, 15% of them will have common bile duct stones. And you can diagnose that with ultrasound a little bit. You know, ultrasound gives you certain measurements that you're allowed to have. Up to age 60, you know, they tell you 6 millimeters or 7 millimeters is good, and then you kind of add a millimeter for every decade after that. If you had surgery, a gallbladder does tend to dilate. So you can get an idea of a dilated common bile duct if it's blocked. And you see on the HIDA scan, you see now here the liver, you see the intrahepatic bile duct. You actually see the gallbladder because it does fill, but you're not seeing anything in the small bowel. So this gives you a diagnosis of a common bile duct obstruction. So what do we do with these stones? Well, first-line treatment is going to be, of course, ERCP. You go in with the scope. You access the ampulla. You can do a sphincterotomy. You can put balloons up to drag the stones out, and it's the first line. But what if you do if you can't do an ERCP? There's a lot of reasons you can't do an ERCP. Sometimes the patients are too old, too sick to have anesthesia. Oftentimes it's a matter of anatomy. They've had gastric bypass. They've had a Billroth II. They've had some other surgery that prevents the scope from reaching there. So in those cases, they would come to us for a percutaneous transhepatic cholangiogram, or PTC. So in a PTC, we get access percutaneously, so we go through the side, through the skin, go through the liver. I like to use ultrasound, but some people do it without. But I prefer whenever there's a chance of me using ultrasound, I use it because it does make my life easier. People that tend to not use ultrasound and say, well, I can do it without ultrasound, tend to be people that are really not comfortable using ultrasound, no matter what procedure they're doing, because it does take a different kind of skill set. It does take a different kind of hand-eye coordination to use ultrasound than it does with a lot of the other things that we do. But once we have access to the bile ducts, we can do a lot of things. We can certainly do a cholangiogram and see, you know, here we see that stone. This patient had cholecystectomy before, so you see the clips here. And then you see the stones. You can kind of see them in a different projection. You saw that these are really stones here sitting. So what do we do with that? We can't do an ERCP. We can't do a sphincterotomy. Well, there's a lot of tools that we have to handle it from a percutaneous approach. We can put in a balloon and do a sphincteroplasty, so to speak. And then we have other tools at our disposal that we can use. Not sure how well this projects, but this is a snare. Not a snare, it's a basket, actually, where we trap the stones inside this basket, and we can either crush the stones or try to push the stones out, or if they're small stones, we can try to pull them out through the tract. You know, we can take snares and snare if they're little stones, and again, either push them down or pull them out. And we can take balloons. After we do a sphincteroplasty, then we can take those balloons over a guide wire and push those stones out into the duodenum. Now, this particular patient had these extremely large stones. I don't know if you can see them. There's almost like a square one here, and it's big, big filling defects, almost these like square stones. I mean, these all develop de novo inside this common bile duct of a patient who had a cholecystectomy a long time ago. So these were gigantic stones, and they weren't going to be easy to push and pull. So we did this, this with the help of, I don't know if he's here, Dr. Steinberg. Actually, he's away. So this was a joint case that we did. And here's a cholangioscope. There's actually no such thing as a cholangioscope. It's a ureteroscope that we steal from our urology buddies up in the OR. But once we stick it in a bile duct, it automatically becomes a cholangioscope. So we stick that into the common bile duct. And we take a little laser fiber, we put that through the scope, and we blast away. And this is very effective, and it's also quite a lot of fun, you know, to blast away at stones with a laser. You can't go wrong using lasers like that, right? So this patient, we took these gigantic stones and turned them into this kind of rubble. And then at that point, once they're fragmented into small pieces, then we can use all our tools to basically pull them, push them, crush them, and push them into the small bowel until we get rid of all these stones. So this actually, this cholangioscope and laser ablation of these stones was published last year by somebody as a case report in 2018. And our patient here, this was back in 2013, so we're many years ahead of the curve on this, but unfortunately we didn't publish it. So moving on to our next patient, this is an 82-year-old with painless jaundice. So some of you are thinking, oh, painless jaundice, it must be pancreatic cancer. And you'd be right most of the time, because that's usually a presentation for pancreatic. I mean, if you see that painless jaundice, you think pancreatic cancer. You see the dilated bile ducts here on the MRI. This looks like a crab. These are all markedly dilated bile ducts. You see the markedly dilated bile ducts, and you see a stricture here where you don't see any of the bile. And then you see a more normal-looking common bile duct below that. Now, with pancreatic cancer, your problem is going to be down here. You're going to see that the obstruction is where the head of the pancreas should be, and that's where the pancreatic cancer usually goes. But in this case, this part is actually quite normal, and the obstruction is higher up. again, you can see it on MRCP, not a great picture, but you do see that there's a kind of like a gap here. So ERCP is, again, for if you have a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer or you're suspecting it, ERCP is first line because you can do a biopsy, you can do a stent, you can do a lot of things to treat it. And here's an example of an endoscopic ultrasound-guided biopsy. This was actually from Dr. Steinberg. And what you see with ultrasound, when you put that ultrasound through the endoscope right smack against the tumor, and you're only a couple of millimeters away from the tumor, between the ultrasound and the tumor itself, you get a really incredibly good view. In fact, we see these tumors better with endoscopic ultrasound than any other way, better than MR, better than CT, certainly better than transabdominal ultrasound, because your ultrasound is right up against it. And once you're there, you can also use that to do endoscopic biopsy. Again, these are from Dr. Steinberg's case. But in this patient, unfortunately, they couldn't get through. Whatever reason, the anatomy just was not suitable for endoscopic ultrasound biopsy. They couldn't drain it. So, again, those cases that aren't suitable, they come to us. Again, we do a PTC, get access to the bile ducts. And then once we're there, we can do a whole bunch of things. And you can see here, once we have our access and we do our cholangiogram, you can see how that correlates really well with the MRI. And you can see the strictured segment here. You can see it here. You see it, obviously, a little bit better. You actually see that there is actually flow through that tract, but this is so narrow, the MRI doesn't even pick it up. But you do get a sense that this is exactly the same thing. Once we're there, we can do a biopsy. In this case, a brush biopsy gave us a diagnosis of cholangiocarcinoma. Cholangiocarcinoma is rare, 2,000 to 3,000 cases a year. It's more common in Asia than the United States, and it is associated with PSC, primary sclerosing cholangitis, and chronic parasitic infections, which I guess may be more common in Asia, which is why it's more common there. So once we have our diagnosis, we can certainly do other things. We can put in an external internal biliary drain. And these are great. They're a little bit inconvenient for the patient because they do have part of a tube that sticks out the side of the patient. But the nice thing about it is there's holes here in the side. There's holes all along, holes all the way on the bottom, so that the bile drains internally. The bile doesn't have to drain out into a bag. There's a little tiny tube sticking out. The nice thing about it is that still gives us the access. So if the tube gets blocked, if we need to do another intervention, if we need to relieve a biopsy, redo it, we can just put a wire down and we have access to the bile ducts without putting the patient through a big procedure. But eventually the patients do get fed up with having a tube and we bring them in and we put an internal stent. So not all strictures obviously are extrahepatic. Some strictures are intrahepatic, as we see in this case. And what we see when we see intrahepatic strictures like that, there's a certain differential to that. Certainly, you can see that this would be extremely hard to drain because which duct do you drain, this one or this one or that one? So it would be really hard to drain. But there is a differential you should be thinking. Again, common things are common. You know, liver tumors encasing all these ducts is one. Cirrhosis can encase the ducts. Ischemia, which is usually post-surgery, post-liver surgery, post-pancreatic surgery, you can get ischemia to the ducts by altering the blood flow. PSC is extremely this is the very common appearance for PSC, primary sclerosing cholangitis, and that's what this happens to be. And PSC is an autoimmune inflammation of the ducts that is associated with ulcerative colitis. It leads to biliary strictures and obstructions, and really the only treatment is liver transplant because it's really impossible to drain all of these, at least effectively. Moving on to our next patient is a 63-year-old woman who is an alcoholic, cirrhotic. She's a child's PUB, MELD score of 20, with refractory ascites and GI bleed. Well, these are terms that may be familiar to some of you and not others, but child's PU is a staging system that's used to assess the prognosis of chronic liver disease, especially in the setting of ATIPS and other procedures. And it does predict mortality after surgery or interventional procedures. And the way you calculate this child's PU score is these five factors: the total bilirubin, serum albumin, INR, the amount of ascites, and the degree of hepatic encephalopathy. And depending on the degree of each of these, that assigns a number of 1, 2, or 3. And then basically you just add up the numbers. If it add up to 5 to 6, then you're a child's A, 7 to 9 B, 10 to 15, you're a C. And you can see how that predicts 2-year survival. If you're a child's A, you're 85% chance you're going to be around in 2 years, where if you're a child's C, you're only a 35% chance of being around in 2 years. Well, a MELD score, some of you know, is being developed to determine who gets livers for transplants. So if you guys know that, you'd be wrong because that's not really what the MELD score was developed for. This actually was developed by interventional radiology to prognosticate survival after a TIPS or prognosticate survival. And it uses three values, which is the bilirubin, the INR, and the creatinine in this formula, which you don't have to memorize. You can always look up. But what we found is that when you put these numbers into the formula, that really correlates with a very high degree of certainty with 90-degree mortality. So you see that if you have a score of less than 9, your 90-day mortality is only 1.9%. So you have an over 98% chance of being around in 3 months, whereas if you're 40% or more, your mortality, I mean, you're not going to be around, chances are, in 3 months. So that's why this was, in 2002, adopted by the United Network of Organ Sharing to prioritize patients for liver transplants. Since liver transplants are few, if they think you're not going to live for 3 months, they're going to try to get you a liver sooner. So our woman with alcoholic cirrhosis, kind of middle of the range PUB, child PUB, MELD score of 20, with recurrent bleed, she underwent endoscopy, which is always the first step to do, and they found large bleeding gastric varices. Was placed on octreotide, and octreotide lowers the portal vein pressure, helps lower the portal vein pressure, and supposed to help decrease the amount of bleeding, and went for endoscopic banding, but unfortunately, she was still bleeding. So then she came to us for a TIPS. So what's a TIPS? It's a transjugular intrahepatic portocaval shunt or portosystemic shunt. And the goal is to create a shunt between the portal vein on the inflow side and the hepatic veins and IVC on the outflow side, and to basically bypass the liver with a large amount of the portal vein blood. And that's going to decrease the pressure gradient between the portal veins and the hepatic veins and the IVC, and that's going to lessen the pressure inside those varices, and it's going to hopefully stop the bleeding. So how's that done? Very simple, transjugular. So we go from the internal jugular vein, put our catheter down into the hepatic vein, here in the middle hepatic vein. We put a balloon occlusion catheter, and with the balloon occlusion catheter in place, we can basically measure the portal wedge pressure. So it's kind of this akin to a Swan-Ganz catheter measuring the left heart pressure by inflating it in a pulmonary artery because it gets sort of the back pressure from the other side. Well, balloon occlusion will do the same thing. It will give us an indirect measurement of the portal vein pressure. It doesn't always correlate 100%, but it really correlates really, really well. And what we can also do, as you see in this case, is inject CO2, and the CO2 will permeate across the liver and fill up the portal vein. And it'll give us our portal venogram. Even though we're not in the portal vein, we're actually forcing this through the liver, we're able to get a pretty decent portal venogram. You see the right portal vein, left portal vein, main portal vein. You can see the superior mesenteric vein. You can actually start seeing those varices coming up, even on the CO2 portogram. So once we have that, we can use that as our guide to advance a quite large, very stiff needle from the jugular vein all the way through the liver. And I don't know if you can see it here. It's a little faded. But here's the right portal vein. And basically, we use that as our target. And we're able to target the portal vein, not quite directly. Once we're in the portal vein, once we have access to it directly, we'll put a catheter down. Then we can have a direct portal venogram. We can confirm our portal vein pressures and get our gradient measurements. And we can also see here, we can get a much better look at those varices. You can see these gigantic ascending varices. So we've confirmed all this. What's next is we dilate up a tract. So this cirrhotic liver is pretty firm, so you really have to push pretty hard to dilate up a tract through that liver. And it tends to not stay open if we just dilate it, so we will put in a stent. So we advance a sheath and through that dilated tract, and we put our stent in there. And that stent does manage to keep that open. And we can see here that even with the stent in place, oftentimes you can do the TIPS and call it a day, and that will usually take care of the varices. But I prefer to go back into those varices even after TIPS and coil them off. And that's what that would look like. And they're basically now, they're basically taken care of between the coiling of the varices and the decreased pressure of the portal veins. That usually takes care of it. Again, this is what it looks like. You can see it better on the snapshot, but here's a stent between the right portal vein, and really we extend it up through the hepatic vein, almost to the inferior vena cava, which is why they call it a portocaval shunt, and you can see our coils in place. So this is another cirrhotic man, 53-year-old, acutely bleeding from gastric and esophageal varices. He has elevated serum ammonia, is on lactulose for encephalopathy. Now, encephalopathy is a problem, because with encephalopathy, really, TIPS is kind of contraindicated. Now, some people say you can treat it even after a TIPS, but when you already have somebody who's encephalopathic on lactulose, really that's a contraindication for TIPS, because you're just going to make them basically become disabled from their encephalopathy after that. So what choice do we have for these patients who can't do the TIPS? Well, we have a couple of other procedures. One is this newer procedure called the Brito procedure, the BRTO. And the other one is transhepatic embolization, which doesn't quite have a nice acronym. We'll have to figure one out. So BRTO stands for balloon-occluded retrograde transvenous obliteration of gastric varices. And you can see gastric is actually in the name of this. So, and the reason for that, it doesn't work for esophageal varices. It only works for gastric varices. And so what that means is it's balloon-occluded, so we use an occlusion balloon, retrograde, so we go actually backwards through that, through the varices, transvenous, obviously we go from through the veins, and we obliterate them using the sclerosing agent. The sclerosing agent in the United States that we use is a 3% STS, or sodium tetradecyl sulfate, brand name Sotradecol, and that's what we use. And we take this agent, mix it with a bunch of air and syringes, turn it into a foam, and we inject it. And what that... And the reason that works is if you look here, so this is our patient's CT. Let's see if I can get this to work. Okay, so if you look at the, here's the portal vein, okay, and here's the SMV coming down. And if we keep an eye on that, okay, so you can see now, see this is the start of the varices coming up here. You can see this tortuous varices that are basically backfilling this way because of the pressure. And if we follow these around, let's follow these around. It's kind of hard to follow, but if we follow all these varices around, they come back and drain into this. And this is the body's own way of trying to decompress the pressure out of the portal vein. And what it does is cause a gastric to left renal vein collateral that gets bigger and decompresses those veins. So that's actually draining into the left renal vein, which is draining into the inferior vena cava directly. So this is bypassing, like a natural bypass of the liver. So the key of this Brito procedure, somebody said, well, why don't we just go up through here, the common femoral vein, go up into the IVC, which is a really easy thing to do, that we do all the time, go up into the left renal vein, again, really easy to do, and then go up into this varix and work backwards through that area. And that's pretty much what's done. So here's what that looks like. So here's our patient, the catheter. I put it up from the common femoral vein through the IVC, through the left renal vein, put up this occlusion balloon, and injected contrast. And this is what you see. This is actually the draining vein. So we're filling it backwards from the renal vein side. So everything's actually coming out of the liver, backing up through the portal vein, going through these varices, and then draining out through this. So the idea is you inflate this balloon, you inject this sotradecol foam into it, and the sotradecol foam kind of goes up into this area, scleroses it, and hopefully gets into these gastric varices as well. Now, if it doesn't get into the gastric varices, it's okay because they say that it's still effective even if it just scleroses as much as it does. It's hard to know why that is. It's certainly counterintuitive. You never really want to block the outflow vein, but I guess my guess is that because now you're blocking the only flow for the gastric varices out, then this flow is going to stagnate and thrombose inside these varices. The downside is it's incredibly counterintuitive. It's against everything we're taught. Having the outflow vein occluded is actually going to increase your portal vein pressure because you lost a decompressing mechanism, and it's actually going to worsen any esophageal vein varices. On top of that, your portal vein pressure is actually going to go up because of it, and the gradient is going to be worse. So it works great for gastric varices, maybe, but the other thing also is acutely it can make them worse and it can make them bleed worse because you're basically stopping the outflow, and if the pressure is still high on the inflow side, so in the acute setting, they can actually bleed more until they have a chance to thrombose. And in this patient, we weren't comfortable doing this, or at least I wasn't, because I really wasn't filling enough of it. So even with the balloon occlusion there, I couldn't really fill enough of that retrograde stuff to feel that I'm comfortable doing that sotradecol. So it is effective in gastric varices. It doesn't affect liver function. So if you have a patient with encephalopathy, it doesn't matter. But it's counterintuitive. It does increase portal hypertension. It actually worsens the esophageal varices because of that. So what's the alternative to this? The alternative is this transhepatic embolization. So basically, when we do a transhepatic approach, we can embolize esophageal and gastric varices. We can embolize anything we want. And it is effective in controlling the esophageal and gastric variceal bleeding. It doesn't worsen the liver function. doesn't aggravate hepatic encephalopathy, but as you'll see, it's quite expensive. And the success rate is lower when you don't use it in combination with TIPS. You saw how we coiled the varices when we did a TIPS. This actually works, but it may be a little bit less success. And here you see how this is done. We can see, again, with ultrasound, you can see the portal veins. We can access them directly. And once we have access to the portal veins, again, do a venogram, same patient, and you can see all this tangle of really large varices. And you can actually, if you follow it down, you can see how it's draining into that renal vein, into the inferior vena cava right there. So you can really follow all of this. So this approach is more straightforward in that we're stopping it on this side instead of on the back end. So again, the way that looks is we go in, we do our roadmap so we can see exactly where we're going. We go up with our catheter. We can go up as high as we want. You can really treat these from down here, save a bunch of coils, but I tend to go up a little higher because I want to make sure I have a good result. And basically drop a bunch of coils in there. And that's what it looks like. These are really long coils. They can each be like a meter long, and we just jam stuff them in there. And this is what it looks like, and it stops the flow up these varices. So moving on to something different. This is a 76-year-old man with alcoholic cirrhosis, ECOG grade 2. Child-pewed number comes out of 6, so it makes him class A, so that's pretty good. Presenting with this mass in the left lobe of the liver. So what's this ECOG 2 mean? Well, ECOG is Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group performance status. It's a way to grade performance status of patients from 0 to 5, 0 being hopefully most of us, and 5 is dead. And most of the people, most of our patients are going to be somewhere in between. Well, this patient is a 2, so it's not bad. Ambulatory, capable of taking care of himself, and although not working. So, of course, first thing, try to figure out what it is. We do a biopsy. It comes back, hepatocellular carcinoma. So hepatocellular carcinoma is actually the most common visceral malignancy worldwide, third leading cause of cancer death worldwide, 9th in the United States, with 30,500 new cases a year and 21,000 deaths. They are solitary in a quarter, multiple in a quarter, and diffuse in a half. And when you look at all the risk factors for hepatocellular carcinoma, really the top two, hepatitis B and C, make up almost 80% of them. Maybe we'll be seeing less hepatitis C now that they have the, or even the B, now that we have vaccines. So here's our patient with the mass. Now we have a diagnosis. What do we do? Well, there's a lot of things we can throw at this, anything from best supportive care observation to transplant to a whole bunch of things. So how do we decide how to treat this patient? Well, these are really our four, if we decide to treat them, four treatment options. We have surgical on one side, systemic on the other, and the realm of interventional radiology is this part here in the middle. Now, we'll go through surgery a little bit quick. Surgery is obviously a great answer. You know, they have great five-year survival. Perioperative mortality is pretty low. In select group of patients, it can be the survival is as high as 70%, so it is a pretty good technique. But recurrence is high. With HCC, the recurrence of 5 years is 70%. And the goal of surgical resection is always to have, you know, whatever surgery you do, is to have these negative margins. And you really want to have a 0.5 to 1 centimeter margin on these resections. And we kind of use the same idea in interventional oncology when we treat it with ablation. So candidates for resection, you know, there's certain candidates to develop Milan criteria to figure out who qualifies, who would do best. People who have tumors of less than 5 centimeters or no more than 3 tumors, each greater than 3 centimeters. So, you know, these patients tend to do the best, but there's a lot of obviously things that they wouldn't operate on. You wouldn't operate on patients with mets or major comorbidities. Transplant has great success. Overall survival is really the best. Relapse-free survival is 92%, so it really is the best. But the problem with transplant is they're so focused on numbers and success rates at the transplant centers that basically you look the wrong way or sleeve the wrong way. All these things are exclusion factors and basically says, nope, you can't have a liver. And the reason they can do that is because there's, as of today, actually as of last week when I looked up these latest numbers, there's still 13,468 people waiting for livers. So livers are not easy to come by. So they can be extremely selective on who would give these livers to because they want them to succeed and they want them to survive those livers if they're going to take the trouble of taking somebody's liver and putting it in another person. So again, we go back to the MELD score, and this was adopted by the transplant community. And if you're close to, you know, up here, if you're ready to die, they'll give you a new liver. And the other thing is, if you do have hepatocellular carcinoma, but you fulfill the Milan criteria, so none of them are bigger than 5 centimeters, there's not more than 3 centimeters, it actually gives you a bump on your MELD score. So it actually speeds up the process of you getting a liver. But our patient, alas, was evaluated by the transplant team and the surgeons, and they both said he's not operable. So that leaves us with these two fields in the middle, the ablation on the left and the regional treatment on the right. And based on those four, I kind of see it from the most effective to the least effective, you know, surgery all the way to systemic therapy. So kind of from left to right, the most to least. So the next step would be the percutaneous ablation. And percutaneous ablation comes in two forms, the thermal, which is heat and cold, and non-thermal, which is ethanol injection and something called IRE. Ethanol injection was the first one, very simple, just like a biopsy. You put a needle into the mass and you inject dehydrated alcohol. It's extremely cheap, and it's very effective, at least in tumors of less than 2 centimeters. In a cirrhotic liver, the ethanol basically is held within the softer tumor, and basically it's very effective. And it's still, to this day, very widely used in countries that don't have big healthcare budgets because of the low cost. But since we have the advent of RFA, the RFA radiofrequency ablation is more predictable, and it's nowadays is what's really used here. With RFA, we put a needle into that liver, just like we put a biopsy needle, except we deploy these tines. You can see all these little tines that deploy inside the tumor. We connect it to a generator. We turn on the generator, and that causes oscillation of ions, and that basically, just from the friction, causes the elevation of temperature at that area at 100 degrees. And basically, it cooks the tumors. This is what that looks like. Here's a RFA needle deployed inside this tumor, and that's it. And you really want to get, again, you want to get that ablation zone to be bigger than the actual tumor. So, again, the goal is to achieve an A0, which is an ablation zone with about a 0.5 to 1 centimeters of tissue. So RFA, how does it compare to surgery? Well, the 5-year overall survival is between 50 to 64%. It's, again, most favorable for tumors that are less than 3 centimeters because those are the ones usually you can get a good margin on. For tumors that are less than 2 centimeters, which you can almost always ablate completely, the overall survival at 5 years is almost 100%. And there is, I'm not going to put a lot of data out there, but there was a study comparing ablation with surgery. And if you look at the data comparing 1-, 2-, 3-year, and 4-year data, comparing ablation to surgery and select groups of patients, you find that it's pretty dead even. So there's really no statistical difference between the two. So for small, solitary HCCs, RFA offers similar advantage, similar survival rates to surgical resection, and is actually a good alternative. The rates of success with RFA does decrease, obviously, in larger tumors. You can't get a good ablation. It does decrease near big vessels. If you have a vessel that's more than 3 millimeters near a tumor, what that does is it draws heat away from the tumors and creates what's called a heat sink and cools the edge. And then you don't get a really great ablation right up at the edge. And areas where you can't get a margin, subcapsular areas, really is at the edge, you don't get a completely favorable control. This brings us to microwave, which is actually very similar to RFA. We put needles in, and RFA in the microwave causes oscillation of water molecules, and that actually increases the temperature to 150 degrees Celsius. So it's not as prone to heat sink as the RFA because of the higher temperature, simply. So here's what those, they call them antenna, not needles. So these are the microwave antenna, and they have, I guess, a little antenna at the tip here that generates the microwave energy. And the way we do that is we place that. Now I see Carrie, my ultrasound tech, just walked in. So we do that together. And here's the needle going right into this mass. This is a hepatocellular carcinoma in the liver. This is what it looks like with the needle inside that lesion on ultrasound. And this is what it looks like in CT. Now here, in this patient, we put 2 needles. And you can alter the shape of these ablations and you alter the size of these ablations by putting multiple microwave antennas in place. With the radiofrequency ablation, it's a little different. Those umbrella things that you show, the tines come in different sizes, so we can size them up that way. With the microwave, we size them by putting multiple antennas and changing the amount of wattage we put in. So the advantage is higher temperature and not prone to heat sink. And that's really pretty much it. There's really not much disadvantage, although there may be some. The other end of the spectrum is the cryoablation, where we use cold, obviously, instead of heat. The way that's done is we put these probes, which have a channel inside the probe that allows us to pump argon gas inside that channel. And the argon gas drops the temperature at the needle to minus 40 degrees Celsius, which is also actually minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And by doing that, it can freeze the cells, ice expands, cell membranes break, and then when you warm them, the cells basically lose water and they get dehydrated, and the cells die. So here's an example. Here's a tumor that we elected to do cryoablation on. And the nice thing with cryoablation is under CT, you can actually see the ice ball. You can see the ice ball forming right in front of your eyes. And this is all ice here. That's not tumor. You can see the tumor is this small, but we can see what kind of margin we have by seeing the size of that ice ball right in front of us. So overall, percutaneous ablation has a very favorable response profile and should be considered in anyone who can't undergo surgical resection, maybe just as good for lesions less than 3 centimeters as surgery, and it does prolong survival for lesions that are between 3 and 5 centimeters. What do we do about lesions that are bigger than 5 centimeters or patients who have multiple lesions? Well, that takes us to our other side of our table, the regional approach. And we have two things that we can offer. We have TACE, which is the traditional transarterial chemoembolization, and the relatively newer. We've been doing that here a long time, actually. We've been doing that for about 8 years here. We're one of the first centers in Florida to offer it, which is the TARE, which is similar to TACE, as you'll see, but involves radioactive material. So in regional therapy, as opposed to targeted ablation, we're treating a whole segment. So if the segment has one lesion, if it has 20 lesions, it doesn't really matter because we're treating one segment at a time. And with chemoembolization, it takes the agents that we're going to deliver is doxorubicin and cisplatin for the most part, and we're going to mix that in with a lipid agent that's going to allow us to both stain it and allow us to see it because of the contrast, and it's going to allow it to stick within the tumor. So we're going to put this chemotherapy mixed with the thiol, the pidol, directly into that segment that contains the tumor. So here's one of our patients, and there's actually a lesion here, which you can't really see that well projected. But there's two lesions, one little one here, one big one there. We actually elected to do an RFA on that one because it's small. Can't do an RFA on the big one, so we took the patient in for TACE. So here's the catheter in the left hepatic artery, and here's the tumor. You can see it. And here's what it looks like with the chemotherapy and the thiol. And again, all the staining is from the thiol. You're not seeing the chemotherapy, but the chemotherapy is embedded in that thiol, and it's embedded in the tumor. You're going to get some systemic effects on these patients, but still you're going to get a much higher concentration right at the tumor than you would with systemic chemo. Here's what it looks like on a follow-up CT. Again, you see the thiol staining because it stays stuck into that tumor. You can see a little bit in the normal liver, of course. That's the area that was targeted. You can see that we didn't target anywhere else. And you can see the ablation zone from the RFA that we did on the other tumor. So chemoembolization is actually recommended as a first-line therapy in the patients who can't go ablation or surgery. And that comes about from a study from a long time ago that actually compared the chemoembolization TACE with best supportive care. And there were two studies, and this one you can see the marked difference at 3 years between the chemoembolization and the best supportive care. And this one actually was stopped after this trial was stopped after 2 years because the differences were so vast. So, of course, now there's a whole bunch of new agents that we can throw at this, tyrosine kinase inhibitors and such, and I'm yet to see anyone willing to do a head-to-head study, but these studies are very expensive, and it's hard to get funding, and I don't think these companies that are making a lot of money off these agents really want to see their agent fall less than the standard. But comparing the historical reference of the chemoembolization with what we have seen now with the newer agents, the chemoembolization is still the way to go. So here's our patient. Here's the big tumor that we treated, and you can see that. And you can see the effect on a follow-up CT. You can see the effect on follow-up MRI. This one looks great. That was ablated. This one actually looks great. You can see a little bit of staining still left from the thiol, but this patient did really, really well. So transarterial radioembolization, or TARE, as we like to call it, is similar to TACE, except you take these glass or these resin microspheres, and that just basically depends on what company you get them from, and they're embedded with yttrium-90, and we embolize them just like we would chemoembolization, would embolize this radioactive material. And Y90 is a byproduct kind of uranium fission in the reactors, and it has a beta decay, so it emits these electrons, or positrons, and with a half-life of 64 hours. Now, the thing with beta, we can't image beta. So if we give a patient beta radiation internally, there's no way for us to see that. None of our scanners can detect it. But these beta radiation particles will interact with matter and cause these secondary photons or secondary X-rays that are generated from this interaction. And those are actually things that we can measure. We actually put them inside the PET scanner, even though it's not a PET, because we're not giving FDG glucose. We're able to measure the secondary X-rays, which are called the Bremser-Long X-rays. And this is a patient that got yttrium to the right side of the liver. And you can see the tumor here. And when we look at the follow-up Bremser-Long scan, this is what it looks like. And you can see these are the secondary X-rays. You can see this is all the radioactivity. Most of it is inside the tumor. And because these are secondary X-rays and they're not coming directly from the beta particles, you do get some non-target registration. This is not really sitting here on the bone. We didn't send that particle there. But you do get some of these artifacts because they're sort of coming from different places, the X-rays. So transarterial radioembolization is an alternative to TACE. It's safe in patients with portal vein invasion. And chemoembolization, you don't want to use it in patients with portal vein invasion, really, because you're really stopping the arterial flow you're stopping both basically all the flow. If you have portal vein invasion and you're giving TACE, it's going to be a problem because now you're stopping the arterial flow in a patient who has compromised portal venous flow. But with radioembolization, you're not actually using the embolic material to stop the flow to the tumor. You're using it radiation, so you can use it in patients with portal vein invasion. It has similar efficacy to conventional TACE, but it has much less toxicity. We've sort of transitioned mostly to TARE as opposed to TACE because the patient do much better. The radiation does have effect if they have a lot of fatigue for the next few weeks, but that tends to be about it, maybe mild nausea, whereas the post-chemoembolic syndromes, they tend to get a little bit sicker after the procedure. So what about other than HCC? Well, we've had various success with these radioembolization and chemoembolization with other tumors. Here's a patient with neuroendocrine tumor. This is a 60-year-old man, metastatic carcinoid tumor with carcinoid syndrome on sandostatin. He really was pretty miserable, and you can see his liver here just full of tumor. This is really all tumor here instead of liver. This is all tumor. In this patient, we did a yttrium-90 radioembolization. You can see that we preemptively coiled the gastroduodenal artery and right gastric artery, and that's because that hepatic artery was really close to those origins. And we don't want to send that radiation to the stomach or to the duodenum because that would cause really bad ulcerations, which are notoriously difficult to treat. So we will sometimes preemptively coil those things, and that really has no effect on the patient. We do this all the time without effect. Then we go up and inject the yttrium-90 into the left lobe, and then this is what it looks like on the Bremser-Long scan. You can see we got really excellent distribution of Y90, and then we go back usually 30 days later and we do the other side. And the reason we don't do them all at once, because if you radiate the entire liver at one time, you could send that liver into liver failure. So we treat half, see how the liver functions handle it, and if 30 days later they're doing well, we can treat the other half. And you can see the response in this patient, which is fairly dramatic. And this is not HCC, as a reminder. This is a neuroendocrine tumor. And you can see the before picture here and the after. Necrotic, really, you see much more normal liver than you saw on the pre-picture. Well, I wasn't sure if we're going to have much time left, but if we do, we have time for one more thing. This is a patient with some large tumors in the right lobe. This is really too big for ablation. Really would be too big for surgical resection, especially since there's tumors on both, not both sides, but there's more than one tumor, but they all happen to be on the right lobe of the liver. So the idea of this patient is like, well, what if we take the whole right lobe out? We can take all the tumors and cure the patient. And that's a great idea, except this patient didn't have enough left lobe of the liver left. So there wasn't enough volume of left lobe to make this patient survive after surgery. So what we do then is go in from the right side. And the reason we use a right-sided approach is because I don't like to go through the left lobe because that's the one that we're trying to save. So in case we have a complication, in case we have bleeding, we don't want to have it in the left lobe. If we have a complication on the right lobe, well, we're taking it out anyway. Although you could see that if we didn't come from the left, it'd actually be an easier shot to get to the right. I prefer to go from the right and kind of make a U-turn. So here, again, we access the portal vein directly, just as if we're embolizing the varices, except instead of embolizing varices, we kind of turn back on ourselves and then face the right portal vein branches. And then from that point, we can inject a whole bunch of particles. Sometimes I'll use coils to make sure that we have stasis in that vessel. And then you can see here, now we're seeing, this is the left side. You can see parenchyma here on the left. You can see flow to the left. But you kind of see like this sort of pruned tree appearance. You're not really getting flow to that right lobe. This is what a portal vein embolization looks like. And this is a before and after, so you can see the left lobe. You can see kind of like it's concave here. You can see the size of it before, and you can see how it ballooned up, and it got much bigger after the embolization. You can kind of see the effects a bit of the embolization here. The right lobe shrunk, the left lobe grew, and that's what you want because now it's safer to resect that right lobe because the patient has enough left lobe left. And that's pretty much it. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you guys. I hope you liked it.